It's Tuesday. It's 12:30. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. Today's first guest is a local treasure, the pastor Frank Triggs. We're going to be talking about the past holidays, Easter and Passover. We'll talk about similarities and myths. We want to talk about anti-Semitism versus anti-Israel sentiment and Frank's recent trip to the Holy Land and Israel in particular, and how Christian values inform political views. Frank, welcome to your first visit to PWM.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
It's great having you. And then at 1 o'clock, we have Dr. Sarah Forsyth. She is a regenerative healing educational consultant, and we're going to talk about the rise of regenerative medicine, how regenerative alternatives compare with traditional pharma treatments, and her protocols for better health. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Frank, I mean, I'm sure most people know you, but tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, you told me before we went on air that you're a reformed insurance guy. Okay. Yeah. how did insurance lead to your relationship with God and becoming a pastor?
Well, insurance didn't really lead to my relationship with God. That started first, and I sensed a call of God in my life for ministry. But my start was in small churches. Therefore, I had to be bivocational, all the way from working in a steel warehouse, driving a truck, then landing. What a cushy job, an office job. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven sitting there handling claims and doing insurance work. That was wonderful. And it was great experience and training for my management later in pastoring churches.
So how long ago did you become a pastor? Do you officially become a pastor when you get a congregation? Is that what happens?
Yeah, sure. A pastor when there's a congregation out there. Before that, you're just a minister.
Okay,
Preparing, you might be on the church staff and be one of the pastors on the church staff. But I started out as a lead pastor in a very small church of 26 people. Hmm. And so insurance, I love it. It paid my bills.
There you go. And you have three children who are now pastors, correct?
I do.
How did that all happen?
Well, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I had hoped one of them become a rich businessman and support me in my old age. But I have two daughters and a son. My daughter and her husband serve a church in Lakewood, California. Okay. He's the lead pastor, and she is on staff as a staff pastor. Before that, she was a minister.
Who really runs the thing, though? Her or him?
Probably my daughter.
Okay. Just checking.
Before that, she had worked as our children's director for our denomination in what we call Southern California. That's from Fresno to the Mexican border. Mm-hmm. So she's a very accomplished speaker and a world-class ventriloquist, so the kids really love her.
Wow.
And my youngest daughter is in Bakersfield serving with her husband. He's an executive pastor of a mega church that has some seven campuses, one in San Luis Obispo, and they both serve in the administration of our denomination that which you are a part of. And then my son, he's got the great job. He pastors a church I used to pastor in Ojai, California.
All right.
And just talked to him right after Easter to see how things went. Matter of fact, it was yesterday because he was just too tired to talk to me on Easter Sunday in the evening.
I'll bet. It's a long day, huh?
It was a long day.
And how was, I know you went out to the Easter ceremony in Shandon. At the chapel?
Yes.
How did that go? Was it well attended?
It was well attended. Amazing time out there. And the Clark family is very hospitable. They provide a cowboy breakfast following it with tri-tip.
All right.
And so, and we can't even smell it inside the chapel, so that's good. It doesn't. It was an excellent service. Had three different speakers from a wide variety of Christian backgrounds. One was a Catholic priest, then there was one evangelical, maybe two evangelicals. I'm not sure because I'm not acquainted with the lady minister that they had, but she did an excellent job.
So, you know, we just finished up with Pesach, Passover,
yes,
and Easter. And I know we wanted to talk just a few minutes about the similarities and the differences between the two holidays and
sure,
how they connect with each other. So I'll let you take it away here.
Okay. As was a surprise for me when I began in ministry and started reading the Bible for Sirius, I discovered that in the King James Bible is the only translation that the word Easter appears. And so I checked it out, and it turns out that is a mistranslation. And I'm a big King James fan. I now use the New King James, which has taken care of some of the antiquity of that particular translation. That word in the original is Passover. It is not Easter. Probably they used and chose the word Easter because that was culturally what everybody knew about at the time. But in reality, Passover and Easter are intricately connected. And let me use the word, I guess I'll just use the word Easter. But it's based upon the Passover and the Jewish traditions of Passover. Jesus was observing Passover and eating the Passover meal in the night that Judas betrayed him. And this brings about the reality that Christianity has no other foundation but Judaism. From the ancient teachings of the Torah and what is called the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, all of our writers, with the exception of one, were Jews. All of our prophets were Jews. I think Luke, who's the author of Luke and Acts, are the only one that was a Gentile writer. So we owe a great deal as Christians to the Jewish people and, of course, the covenant of the Old Testament, and or you could call it the former testament, because we still think every believer has to follow the Ten Commandments, but we don't do it from the external. We do it from the internal. As Christ said, he was writing those laws on our heart.
Mm-hmm. And what was I going to ask you? There's also, I mean, a lot of, I guess, I don't want to say pagan, but, you know, Roman antecedents in Easter. You know, I mean, when was the first Easter celebration, so to speak, for the Christians?
Most likely, because we don't know for sure. It might have been around the second century.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, the word Easter, it's a misnomer, because, again, it should be Passover. But the word Easter is a slight corruption of Ishtar, which was a heathen goddess.
Okay.
And it came out of the Roman experience.
Mm.
But our celebration of, quote, Easter has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a Passover meal, the betrayal of Jesus, his crucifixion, and his resurrection.
All right, let's move to your trip. You recently took a trip to Israel.
Yeah.
It's not your first, but this one was specific to you getting, I hate to use this word, but a bird's eye view or a tour of the actual October 7th, 2023 massacres that occurred.
Yeah, Barry, that's a very good way to put it.
And so tell us a little bit about that and what you learned from that. I mean, some of the, I don't want to even say highlights, but because I'm sure it was quite a moving, I mean, I watched some of the film video that you sent me, and it kind of, a lot of the descriptions of what happened reminds me of the Holocaust. You know, having gone to the Holocaust Museum I've gone to Israel a couple of times as well. So, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we went to Nova the first day.
Mm-hmm.
So after a 14 and a half hour plane trip, getting a little bit of rest and having our internal clocks messed up, our first day was at Nova, where the invasion took place. That took place many places, but that is where there was a music festival going on, and it was a secular festival of young Jewish people, and it was celebration. And I don't think I was quite prepared to stand on the dirt where the blood was in the sand.
Mm.
We saw the memorials of each person that was killed or captured, and it was extremely moving. I'm one of these people that when I first see something shocking, it doesn't affect me. But 24 hours later, as it ruminates in my mind, you realize what happened there. And today, now, as I'm talking to you, I can feel my emotions welling up within me about what happened and the atrocities that took place there, simply because those people were Jewish. There's no other reason. And so we spent that first day there. We had a service of 1,000 pastors then gathered, and we made awards to some of the hostages that had been released, some of the families that had stood courageously, and we recognized them. And one of the things that impacted me in that service is this was a Christian organization standing up with Jewish leaders saying, "We stand with you, we love you, we care about you, and we will speak out and do whatever is necessary to speak against such atrocities against your people. We owe our faith to the Jewish people." And there was no compromise of our Christian message, and there was no compromise of their Jewishness. I thought it was wonderful.
So as a result, you know, unfortunately, as a result of all this, I mean, our attention has been focused on the Middle East now and continues to be focused on the Middle East since this time. I mean, it's, you know, it's all, it was always kind of, it would come in and out of focus, you know, as there was a flashpoint or something like that. But this has been an ongoing conversation now. And one of the big issues in the United States, and in my experience as well, is a real, what appears to be a rise of anti-Semitism. Now, but I've kind of been corrected by some of my younger friends, and I have a few who say it's not really anti-Semitism; it's more of an anti-Israel sentiment. So, after going on this trip and from the people you talk to, what's your opinion on this? Is it anti-Semitism or is it anti-Israel sentiment that we're seeing?
Oh, my response to that is yes.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, what I mean by that, well, not exactly. Maybe two sides of the same coin. And I think it's a matter of misinformation about the history of Israel and the history of the land. Because people who refer to the Jews as being colonizers or occupiers, they don't know history. Because every time you have an archaeological dig in that area, you will find artifacts that refer to the Jewish people that are not in scrolls, but in clay tablets. Their history is way before Christ and the time of the Exodus, somewhere around 1400 BC. Mm-hmm. So they have been in that land a long time. Everybody else is an occupier.
They just found something else recently. I read somewhere an ancient bullet that were used in slings that proved. I saw this I can't remember exactly where, but it was one of the Easter, you know, articles. And yeah, they keep finding all these old antiquities that, you know, show that, you know, the Jews were there for a long time.
A long time, and they're just reoccupying the land that God gave to them and promised to them and said would be theirs forever. Uh-huh. The prophet Amos was very clear on that God has made a covenant with the Jewish people, and he has never canceled his part of the covenant.
So this brings another topic that's, again, sure, in the news. You know, and you wanted to talk about this. I mean, for the last 60, 70 years, you know, the relationship between Jews and Christians has actually become closer.
Yes.
But now all of a sudden, and so that's a good thing, so I want you to talk about that. But now all of a sudden we have this whole movement of Christians who, and they're called supersessionists, who believe that, you know, one of the tenets is, that came up over the last 50 or 60 years, I think, is that Christians were grafted into the Jewish tradition.
Yes, that's from the book of Romans.
Right. But the supersessionists say, well, now it's time for the Jews to give it up, and they're not the chosen people anymore. So there's this woman who used to work for Trump. What was her name? Brigine. She was I think she was a Miss America. And several of these other Christians that are out there saying, yeah, Jews have to give it up and it's time for them just to become Christians. What make some comments here about how you see things have evolved and about these folks that are making these comments now.
Well, one thing I would say, my observation is they are ignoring the pages of the Bible that they say they believe in. They believe the Bible to be the Word of God, and they're totally ignoring what it says. Again, the prophet Amos, he indicated and prophesied that the land belonged to Israel, and God's covenant with them was forever. Okay, the idea that the Jewish people may have failed, what people don't fail? Everybody fails. And the whole concept of Christianity is that we're failed people that need a Redeemer and Savior. And so God didn't cancel his part of the bargain just because people have at times have thought that or moved in a way that they thought would cancel theirs. So they have misread the New Testament as well, where the Apostle Paul said, we're grafted in. We are not the vine. We're a branch. The Christians are a branch that's been grafted in to the promise of God. We believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Where did we get that? The Jews! So,
yeah,
that promise has never failed. So, and the Bible says God's not a man that he should lie, nor the Son of Man that he should repent.
So again, what did you take away? Because we've got like another minute or so left here. What did you take away from your trip and bring back to the United States? And as you talk to people, what's the primary message that you got out of that trip?
I would say the primary message is that we need to support the Jewish people. It is a righteous thing to support Israel and Israel's right to be in the land. If anything, I am a Christian and I am a Zionist. That makes me a scary thing. I'm a Christian Zionist.
That's something. Well, you know, again, and what do you, how do you see this all playing out? I mean, because obviously we've got some, I guess, contention in the United States now. Again, yeah. And I've never seen, again, I can't remember experiencing any anti-Semitism as a kid. You know, maybe a few times, but nothing like systemic. But it seems like there's a systemic growth of this happening in this country. Do you think it's going to get worse before it gets better?
I hope not. But humanity's nature is hard to predict. I'm hoping that people begin to realize, and the church will wake up, to our dependence upon the Jewish people. And the fact that we wouldn't have a Bible if it weren't for the Jewish people. The fact that we wouldn't know about the God that has that holy, unpronounceable name the Jews have, if it were not for the Jewish people.
All right. Well, on that, I hear the break music, so we'll take about a two-minute break, and then I want to turn to how your Christian values inform American politics and your politics. So, folks, stand by. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Pastor Frank Triggs. You can call or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Well, you know, when I was growing up, Frank, they used to say the two things you're not supposed to talk about are politics and religion, in good company, I guess, or something like that. But it seems like we've got a connection now, you know, that the religious side, on both sides of the aisle, both the left and the right, are speaking out about politics. So tell us a little bit about how your Christian faith and values impact your political views.
Well, first of all, I have to say what I had before my Christian faith was, as a kid, I loved going to the movies. I'd go to the cowboy movies, and you talk about John Wayne, you talk about Tom Mix, and names that a lot of young people have never heard of today. And there was always the hero, you know, the good guy and the bad guy.
Right.
And that's how some of my values were being formed, because I came from a broken home that, I can say my father was married 4 times, my mother 3 times. And so I know what raw life is all about.
Mm-hmm.
A stepfather who wasn't real thrilled about starting his marriage with a child already that wasn't his.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of trying to figure things out on my own until one day I came to an encounter with Jesus Christ that totally changed my life and healed a lot of the anger and the hurt and the bitterness that was within me. So then in reading the scriptures, the church I went to at that time said that Christians read the Bible. I didn't know that a lot of them don't. So I started reading the Bible, and my values began to form on what was found in the pages of scriptures. And I thought, this is amazing. This is how I'm supposed to behave. And it wasn't because I was threatened with hell if I didn't do those things. It was because there was somebody bigger than me that knew what was right and wrong. And I began to understand that, and it formed my values. I found out that the Bible is very pro-capitalist. I know there's people that have problem with that because they think that, the early Christians, they were socialists. They pooled their funds and they gave them away to one another. But the thing they miss, whether it's a Christian community that's living like a kibbutz, because that looks like a socialist, but it's not, because you're free to walk in and you're free to walk out. It was totally 100% voluntary. People wanted to do it. They did it of their own free will. Socialism has never been by free will. And you can vote your way into it, but it's rare that you could vote your way out of it. And so I discovered that, the Lord knows about profit and loss. He knows about one man that did it wrong. I had a sermon called Bigger Barns and Smaller Hearts. You know, he'd tear down the barn so he can store more of his stuff. And that God's provision for prosperity, so we'll be able to give, be able to be generous, be able to bless others, and not have a government looking down their nose at us and saying, we're going to take it and we're going to give it. We're the ones that should be generous.
Yeah. So what do you think about, I mean, the left has now coined this term Christian nationalism. If it's what they say, then, you know, I'm probably one, but I mean, you know, Christian nationalist, but I mean, what do you make of that whole criticism they're putting those two words together for a reason.
They are. And I wish they would define them specifically, because I'm a Christian and I'm a nationalist. I believe in our nation. I believe that we are to submit to the rulers, as the Bible says, unless they conflict with our faith. And then we have to prepare to take the consequences. In the early church, they were slaughtered and martyred by the thousands, by Rome, because we could not burn incense and say Caesar is Lord, because we only had one Lord. So I wish they'd define that. If they are coming against the fact that the nation was founded on biblical principles, and here's that wonderful word, and I think it's a good one, on Judeo-Christian principles, if they're fighting that, they're wrong, because we were founded on those principles. And today, as a matter of fact, if you read some of the early founding fathers, you discover that the one thing that they stood against as far as religion was Islam. It was an invader. Those are not the principles that our nation was founded on. We were founded on the Judeo-Christian principles. Now, if that makes me a Christian nationalist, I guess so, but I don't want to let them define what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Christian. I believe in America. And I pray every day, God save America.
Well, right. I mean, our first post-constitutional war was against the Barbary pirates.
Yes.
Who were, you know, kidnapping our sailors and selling them back to us for profit. So, real quickly, because we have like a minute left, and this will be something that we'll talk about on another time. But
sure.
Historically, when the United States, in Anglo-American history, when we're in a winter, you know, when the old institutions that we've gotten used to are we question everything today, okay? But then there's that we call that a winter in the generational history aspect of things. We're eventually going to get into a spring, and one of the hallmarks of a spring is an awakening, a religious awakening. And there's been a lot of talk about this, that young people, especially young men, are going to church and because they want to have families and they want that connection. What are you seeing out there?
The scripture says in the book of Acts that there are seasons of refreshing that come from God. It's like there are some seasons where there is an open heaven and there is a revival going on. And the scriptures prophesy that in the last days, and by last days, there's no end of the world in the Bible. There's a beginning of a new world.
Yep. Well, we'll hold that thought, and we'll talk about that the next time you come and visit. Thanks so much for coming in, Frank. All right, folks, when we come back, we'll be talking with Sarah Forsyth. She's a doctor of regenerative medicine. So stand by.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Dr. Sarah Forsyth. She is a regenerative healing educational consultant. We're going to be talking about the rise of regenerative medicine, how regenerative alternatives compare with traditional pharma and other treatments that we've gotten used to over the last 50, 60 years or so. And then we're going to talk about protocols to better health. You can call. Oh, Sarah, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming on. And folks, you can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Sarah, you have a long and significant track record in the field of medicine. Tell us about your journey from family medicine and how you got interested in regenerative medicine.
I think probably my interest started when I was young, and I think it's some seeds get planted at different points in your life. And I think when I became a physician, and as I started to see that kind of my hopes for what medicine would be were not what I thought they would be, just as I went through my training, and the outcomes I was seeing with the pharmaceutical regimen that were standard protocol, I think a lot of my experience as a child really came up. My grandmother ran a nutritional foundation, and I just kind of grew up around it without thinking much of it. But I was often around elderly people that were quite healthy and active, and outliving and lived quite natural lives. And that kind of, I think, was just a standard. And after going through medicine and, you know, working in large academic center training there, and then moving out into the community and having kind of a recipe book through my academy about how we would treat various ailments and how we would work them up. Over the years, you know, I was a bit disenchanted. I would see patients really just get decline and sicker and sicker each time they come into the hospital, and outpatients, you know, addressing their hypertension or their high cholesterol and, you know, putting them on the medications, you know, one by one, adding each additional one and just not seeing much movement. And I just always had a sense that, you know, I really feel like I'm working against bigger things, and we're not doing well. And so I think seeing that, and then also, and I think what typically happens a lot of times, I think, when people enter more natural medicine is that they have healing crises within their own families. And so we definitely had those with our children. They did not do well under the allopathic system. I didn't do well. And it took many years to kind of realize what was what, because there wasn't really a good algorithm in any of my academy journals to really explain what was happening. But I knew they weren't doing well. I knew I wasn't doing well. And I had seen much healthier people. And as a college student, I was actually an anthropology major, and I did an honors program in medical anthropology at UCLA. And a lot of my interest in that was learning about other more traditional cultures and how they lived, how they prepared their food, how they farmed, how they made their medicine. And I got very interested in a lot of those ethnologies, and just because luckily there are a lot of people collecting that data and kind of just understanding the level of health that people that were still living in their native ecosystems were enjoying, and kind of understanding how we were living was very different and very separate from the ecosystem that we used to live in and be a part of.
Yeah.
And so that, I think all of those things really kind of helped me. And I think, you know, I probably would say it was the health issues of my children that really, I think anytime you do anything for your kids. And so I think that probably was the most committed that I ever became. And so I just read volumes. Like, I couldn't get enough information. And I went back and read the entire library that my grandmother had, that she, because they had really been a consortium internationally for collecting health studies, natural health studies from around the world. And so I was very lucky to have that and kind of look back and say, okay, what was being done in this area? And, you know, what is there? Because it was hard to find things on the internet. It still can be. And luckily it's getting easier, and there are more and more consortiums of different levels of practitioners that are looking at the newest data. And luckily internationally, a lot of research is done on plant compounds and food systems. And so we're lucky to be able to enjoy those.
Well, yeah.
It's
interesting. It is. I think we talked about, for an old guy, I consider myself to be reasonably healthy, but I'm just constantly, constantly amazed about people who are younger than me, or my age, or even younger. I mean, whatever, that are just suffering from these chronic, almost intractable illnesses that they just, the modern medicine can't shake. And I know we're going to get more into details on this stuff, I think this is a really, really timely thing to be talking to our audience about. So you wrote me a very nice email. It was very small print, but it was very nice email about what regenerative medicine. And I didn't have to use a magnifying glass, but I just want to quote you. You wrote that you consider regenerative medicine as redesigning our lives to allow for the innate healing that exists within the ecosystems in our planet. So I think you touched on that, but could you drill a little deeper on what you mean by that?
Sure. Yeah, so and that's the way I look at it. I think you could talk to a lot of different practitioners, and depending on how they've come to be where they are, they might look at things differently, and they might emphasize different types of treatment protocols. But I think because of my studying in anthropology, I think my interest in plants specifically, I've really led me to look at ecosystem health. And I've long thought about what makes us different than ancestors that truly enjoyed great health. And I think some of that data was the most interesting to me. There's a lot of literature that came out of shipping logs in the 1800s that I thought was fascinating. Basically, they would collect data and speak to different tribes, I guess would be the best way, but all over the world, groups living in areas where the ecosystems hadn't been changed, where there wasn't industrial agriculture, but pretty much people were living in the ecosystem they inherited and their ancestors lived in. And it was very interesting that in temperate zones, you know, people were living to 150, 160 years of age. They were running around at 90. And in more equatorial zones, they tended to live to about 120, 130. They did not have congenital disorders. There was not mental illness. It was a very slow degeneration. And just mental health was very high. Physical endurance and health was impeccable. And just to be able to see those snapshots and understand that was in existence for us, and probably everywhere on our planet, and where people really adapted and evolved to the ecosystems from which their people came from. And I think just from an evolutionary perspective, to really think the nuts and bolts of it. We tend to really separate ourselves, but obviously we were created on this planet. And if you are, you know, if you agree with the thought that we evolved from unicellular organisms and we became more and more complex, we understand just the infinite number of things that had to go right in the right amount of time to even happen in the amount of time that it has. If it's about, 4.5 billion years that we think our planet's been around, you know, the number of things that had to go right, there is an organizing intelligence that would have to be available to make us possible. Because really, we're the amount of organisms that we have on the planet, the complexity that we have, is truly a miracle. If there isn't an organizing intelligence, and so my point being that we come from our planet. We are made of our planet. The forces that made our planet and made such an elegant design of everything that is on our planet and that is in constant conversation with us and with each other. The plants are communicating. The animals are communicating. We once communicated better. But understanding that if you look at it from a scientific perspective, the communication, if you want to look at it, is really taking place through microbes. You know, there's debate on how many independently functioning microbes we all have besides our human cells, but it's at least half. And they are in constant communication and sharing genetic information and sharing information about the experiences and stresses they're having in the environment. And they're changing to improve the efficiency of their function. And they're sharing that information with us and with the plants share with one another. They share with the animals. And it is that these wild ecosystems that are self-maintaining, they're ever becoming more stable. This is how they stabilize themselves. It's how they rely on diversification of microbes and higher organisms to create bounty. And we are a part of that. And as much as we can remember that, we will share in that well-being. And so I think that really is what I think is the major force. Now, I mean, there's lots of ways to break that down and decide how are we going to re-enter that harmony? How are we going to re-enter that conversation to be healthy? And I think that's really what I'd like my role to be. But I think that really is our ecosystems they're going to be a reflection of our health, and our health is a reflection of their health.
So many of us grew up with the notion, well, you just take a pill for something to fix yourself.
Right.
So regenerative medicine kind of flies in the face of that a little bit. But I mean, I have to say, I think, your field has gotten a big boost from COVID in that many more people have lost faith in big pharma and the stuff that was being fed to us literally so tell us a little bit about, I mean, how did it become, I mean, and we talked a little bit about this we talked about how did it become that big pharma became so big and took control of our lives?
Well, I guess just like I would say any industry, I think I look at it that way, is, you know, our planet is run by fiat, and fiat is the be-all, end-all power, it seems. And people who print fiat create the debt and then issue currency, which is quite centralized, and they have investments. And I think just like anything, we have a global economy, and I think that it is fairly centrally controlled, and there's a lot of power that is disseminated that way. So I think that just in anything, I think it reflects the creation of fiat. And unfortunately, I think that medicine is quite lucrative for biotech and pharmaceutical companies, just like anything, just like gas, energy, power, technology. It feeds a central fiat system. And so that really becomes the bottom dollar. And there are, I think it's simply that. And I don't know that it's a game that most of us are really a part of, but I do think it controls a lot of what we have access to in terms of knowledge and how our governments operate. And I think that's just kind of a sad reality.
Yeah.
And not to sound depressed, but that being said, we all have choices. So how much we decide to participate in certain systems and understanding how global economic systems work, I think it's a personal decision about how we decide how we want to live, because it affects everything we do. I mean, all of us, how we spend our day and how much fiat we can generate to meet the needs of our families. We're participating in a system to get what we need. And I think at some point we decide what are the things that we want to do for ourselves, what are the responsibilities we want to take back for ourselves and not have to trade in our life, our labor for fiat, which we really might not get a very good deal.
There you go.
You know, I think that unfortunately a lot of the skills and craftsmanship and really a lot of the needed things that humans do really don't get well repaid by a fiat system. We're kind of seeing fiat systems, people who do well in fiat systems are people that are in fiat. And so I think in the end it comes back to connection. And again, it comes back to the ecosystem connection. The closer we live to our ecosystems, the more responsible for them, the more it has to give us, and the more intimate and rewarding I think our lives are. So whether that's how we grow our food or participate in some way of growing food, how we participate in managing our own resources, building our own things, having more local economies, I think there's just a lot to be said. And I think I see our food systems and our medicine systems are really going to be, they have those same rules. So I think we'll get out of them what we put into them. But I think it's our responsibility, ultimately. I feel like the more we give away to central authority, we're going to lose. Yeah.
No, but we're coming up on a break here in about 2 minutes, and I just wanted you to touch on a few terms that I think are important, because I run up against them all the time in my end of the insurance business. You know, what role do epigenetics and genomics play in the whole fundamental thing of, you know, regenerative medicine? Yeah.
So, again, going back to ecosystems, that everything that we eat is sharing genetic information with us. It's sharing microRNA. It's sharing proteins. It's sharing, obviously, even if you just look at the contents of essential fatty acids or minerals, anything that you are taking in is going to be a communication. It's going to provide a signal, and it's going to have repercussions on the intra and intercellular level. So these are communications. So epigenetics is really... a lot of it really has to do with the individually functioning biomes of the different organisms that we share our ecosystems with. So largely for us, it's going to be what we're breathing, what we're drinking, and what we're eating. And so these will they will share genetic information. They will also elicit responses from our immune system. And so it will basically be a diplomatic discussion about what is allowed in and what is not allowed in. And it's how we adapt. I mean, that's really the entire point. Mm-hmm. How do we assess what's in our environment, and then how does our body respond appropriately?
And then one of the terms that I picked up and one of the things that you sent me was a term called active metabolites. What are those?
I'm trying to remember. Well, so many things. So every time we eat something or take a medicine, like a compound, often the form that it's in will not bind to receptors to have an intracellular signal. And
okay.
So sometimes what happens is it has to be processed through the liver. It has to be broken down. It can happen in the kidney.
Got it.
But bottom line is having a metabolite that actually has a function and an action on a receptor.
Well, that's great. I hear the music, so I'm going to put you on hold, Sarah. So stand by. All right. And folks, when we return, we'll be back with Dr. Sarah Forsythe, regenerative healing educational consultant. and we're going to talk about some more. We're going to drill down into more aspects of what regenerative medicine can really help with. So stand by. We'll be back in about 2-3 minutes. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Dr. Sarah Forsythe, regenerative healing and educational consultant. This would be a great time for you to call in with questions or text in with questions or comments. 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Sarah, let's drill mm-hmm. down into what regenerative medicine has been successful at so far, really, with helping people. So what are the common kind of treatments that you're seeing out there and the primary approaches?
Yeah. Well, currently, just because I'm working in orthopedics right now, so a lot of my focus has been on musculoskeletal health. And so a lot of what I've had focused on recently has been, well, it's been much more simplistic, actually, than what I was doing before. But I find it interesting because there are people who will have a joint replacement, and then 2 or 3 years later, their bone aches, and I'll look, everything will be fine. Meaning there's no signs of infection, the joint is, the replacement's in place. And then you'll look through medication lists, and that's been really very interesting for me. And about half dozen of their medications will cause joint pain as a side effect. And I think you realize there are a lot of questions every time someone is having pain and having an inflammatory response that causes pain. And basically a bigger issues come to the floor. And some of that has been very interesting to address, to really say, okay, you've had some level of inflammation that has gone on. It doesn't just show up in the joint. It shows up everywhere. And usually you can get that from someone's history. And so then you'll kind of go back and look at, okay, how is the gut being regulated? Meaning, is the gut does it have appropriate microbiome so that it's making enough short-chain fatty acids that are really important for regulating and feeding the immune system? And so you'll look at it from that perspective. That immune system is going to be giving signals for reparation, meaning does the joint lining, do the tendons, do they have the minerals that they need? Do they have the substrate that they need to assimilate nutrients, make energy, recycle nutrients, and remove metabolic waste? And so these become bigger questions because these are why people are having continued discomfort in their bones, their joints, even though it's perfect. Everything looks like, at least anatomically, that it is working well. But we're really seeing that on a metabolic level, and which informs our immune system and our nervous system, there's not a lot of regulation. And so that has been quite helpful. And beyond diet, gut health, having appropriate macronutrients, so fats, proteins are really important for enzymes. Enzymes are really the biochemistry that makes everything happen in the cell. It's what all our signaling involves. Addressing all of those things is very important in getting cells to modulate. And that's really the goal of regenerative medicine, is how are we modulating our responses? We're not trying to force the body to go one way or the other, which is quite a pharmaceutical or allopathic approach, because in my opinion, we're not intelligent enough to do that. But food and plants are, and they've been doing it since the beginning of time. And so for example, I mean, a very useful plant is curcumin longa. So that's turmeric. And it has many compounds, but the most well-studied is curcumin. And at high doses, that works very well. It does numerous things. But what it's great at is it's great at regulating the immune response. And so it's getting a balance of helping repair, but it's helping give an organized repair. So anytime you're stressing a bone, a joint, a ligament, you want there to be repair, but you want it to be organized. You don't want too much. You don't want too little. And these plant compounds, and this being one, is a very good modifier of this. It supports that regulated response. It also is an antioxidant, so it helps protect neurons. It helps protect, cells of everywhere, actually. It protects neurons in the brain, but it also protects myocytes in the heart, in the muscles. And it's very in chondrocytes that line our joints. So we're doing numerous things each time we introduce a plant. It also carries out toxins. So that an example would be metals that do not serve our respiratory chain well. Obviously in the world we live in, people are exposed to things such as mercury, cadmium, aluminum, and these will impair our ability to make energy because they tend to bind more strongly to a lot of our protein complexes in our cells, like in our mitochondria where we make energy, which is crucial for life, for conducting all processes of life. But these proteins are very sensitive, and when those toxins bind there, they will do often irreversibly until those proteins actually break down. And then those metals are released, and they can be reabsorbed into healthy cells again. So they're quite difficult to remove. So having plants that will bind those metals and move them graciously out of the body is a real benefit to improving health. So I would say that's been a big one, is modifying joint pain with or without joint replacement, modifying bone pain, different sources of musculoskeletal pain, and really using a healthy anti-inflammatory that works for many different aspects of health for those cells.
So the real culprit in all the real culprit in our lives is inflammation, and you're thinking probably a lot of this is environmental from. And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong. You know, petrochemicals.
Yes, they all institute dysregulated immune responses. Yeah, they all increase IL-1, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor, and F-kappa-B. They're an extreme amount. They cause an extreme amount of oxidative stress, so they're kind of these free radicals, and they don't break down, and they tend to kind of go around and snag and oxidize our proteins, basically. It's kind of having just just fireworks, I guess, would be a way of traveling around the body, you know, damaging the lining of our endothelium, like our vasculature, our neurons, and they're very difficult for our body to break down.
What about something that keeps coming up recently, and I don't know if you've looked into this, so if you haven't, that's okay, but I just saw an article about the dangers of microplastics. This is a new thing, and have you looked into much of that and have any thoughts on it?
So, the phthalate family, which are in microplastics, and there's some that are stable, the plasticizers that make things flexible, and then, there are those that are volatile, which I actually think are a bigger deal because they're actually being inhaled and they can enter directly into the brain. And they're neurotoxins, meaning they have direct degenerative effects on our neurons. And we have some neurons that can regenerate, but others do much less well. There's just isn't a lot of real estate in the brain. And the other issue is that they directly damage DNA. So when there's replication or repair, they're actually known to stop repair processes. So, we have brain factors that support growth, but it actually blocks neural growth factors in the brain as well. So they work in a many-prong approach that are quite devastating neurologically. And one of the biggest things is actually not just in the brain, but actually it's the neurologic cells or the neurons that are in our hearts or pacemaking cells. So we're seeing a lot more arrhythmias in younger people, and especially women. They don't have large vascular disease. Their arteries aren't clogged, but they have damage to their pacemaking cells. And so we're seeing a lot of AFib, which can lead to heart failure. And we're seeing a lot of medicating for this, which in the end is just anytime we take a medication, it's going to have impacts on our cellular metabolism. And there are consequences for every medication we take as well.
Yep.
So it may be necessary to control a certain symptom, but in the long run, you're going to be looking at you're going to have less longevity in critical cells throughout the body. So.
So I know that your
chiropractic survey.
Yeah, I know your approach to this is mostly nutritional in many regards, but I'm looking at like this list of stem cell therapy, platelet rich plasmas, tissue engineering, yada yada yada. I mean, do any of these have any promise, or is this just where all the research money is going?
Well, I think that's true because
it sounds sexy.
So I think that, we do PRP. So we spin down blood product for patients, and it does separate out important cytokines and cell signalers that signal for repair. And it does show benefit for increased repair of tendons. Now, I think it's great. But I don't think it's a good idea to rely on these alone, because anytime you're not making lifestyle changes, you're going to be fighting against what you're giving yourself. So you might put on a longer Band-Aid. So I think it makes sense if you're wanting to make changes to remove the triggers that have caused the degeneration in your tendons and the reason. I mean, I guess my point is you don't just get arthritis. You don't just get tendinopathy. It's not that you're just old. there are environmental triggers that we are taking in, and we're choosing too often. I mean, obviously we aren't going to live in a perfect world, but we make choices about what we bring into our house. We make choices about what we surround our house with. We make choices about our food and our medicine, and those will ultimately decide what you're going to face in terms of degeneration. And so I think that it is very beneficial, PRP, but I wouldn't do it alone. I think if you don't make necessary lifestyle changes, if you're still smoking, you're still drinking, you still are eating out of plastic, which is an endocrine disruptor and causes insulin resistance and causes pro-inflammatory signaling in your adipose sites, your fat cells, you know, these are all things that are going to be working against your PRP working. So you can pay money for that, but I think it's really important in the long run. If you want it to really work, you're going to have to do the work to manage your immune response and to make sure you have a coordinated repair process for your tendons. And I think it makes, and it's not just for your joints. When you make these changes, you're going to feel better. Your brain will work better. You're going to have better cognitive function. You're going to have better sensation in your hands and in your feet, and you're going to see better. I mean, you're repleting critical functions across your organ system. So, there are benefits to that, but there also might be downsides. We don't really know. We haven't been doing it a ton. And I don't know that we even test for it. I think probably spinning down a little bit of blood product will always be fun, and I don't think people are going to be doing it. You know, you're not doing it a dozen times, so I think it's probably fine. But anytime you're stimulating and you're overriding anything that your body does, there will always be consequences. And I think that's the main point. My point is anytime we aren't giving our body a choice, there's going to be a consequence, because our body is far more intelligent than we will ever be.
All right, a couple of things. You know, if somebody comes and sees a specialist like you in regenerative healing, what are their base labs that you start with? I mean, do you take blood? You know, those types of things. What do you look at?
So I really do a good detailed history, and typically I will take the labs that they've got from their primary care, because there's a lot you can do. For the most part, there's so much basic work in terms of how do we normalize your cholesterol. So that's going to be reducing your oxidative stress. So what are the different ways we do that? By healing your gut, by adding botanicals that are antioxidants. Those are the first things we're going to be doing. I think the only labs, I think a lot of the changes really, or a lot of labs aren't really necessary unless someone is not improving, which typically when they do those things, they're not. Like, you could order an oxidized LDL. So that's a little more specific. that isn't in a typical lab, although it's becoming more and more common. There are other testing. There's other testing such as organic acid testing, which looks at metabolites from the Krebs cycle or your respiratory cycle. So when your mitochondria may make energy, you can look at that because that can be an indicator if someone has ongoing mold exposures, if they have pesticide exposure, if they've got certain heavy, if they're metal stores that are important to address. A lot of the changes that we do baseline will actually help all of those issues anyway, but if people aren't improving, then it can be important to nail those down. But I tend to use very gentle protocols for the long term. I don't think heavy-handed work is necessary. There is more than enough just available in what I would say is safe as food, medicines that move out toxins that really get organ systems cooperating. So I think, you know, I feel like a lot of times there's a lot of fancy tests that I don't think are necessary. I feel like a lot more has to happen at a baseline. So for example, people who have dysbiosis, a lot of times they'll do a lot of stool culture testing. And obviously they'll, look for certain overgrowth, breath tests, but it's small intestinal bowel overgrowth, but, actual overgrowth. But I find that making a lot of these basic changes with certain gut protocols is actually quite helpful. And I don't think use of heavy antibiotics is actually helpful. Instead, I think it's very helpful to rotate, different botanicals that modulate bacterial numbers that really help. You really want a healthy balance. You don't want to have a mass eradication, because in the end, you're going to have to deal with those repercussions.
Yeah.
And it's much better if you can add in diverse foodstuffs and botanicals that actually bring those microbes with them. And so you're really focusing on repopulating in a healthy way and then taking an appropriate prebiotic food so that you can support the healthier balance of microbes that you're bringing in.
Right.
So I think, I think pretty much a lot of things can be done without much else. I mean, I think that those are basic tests that might be added. But other than that, pretty much what you come in with can be worked with. And because I think, 95% of the information we need is really in a good history, a long history from early on, because disease takes decades to occur, not, even though it might be some acute event that made someone think, oh, I'm sick now, but really there were changes over time that were critical and exposures they had over time that were very important.
Eliminating
those makes a big difference.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we got like 2 minutes left.
And
I know we're going to spend some time on the other side of the break talking about some of your nutritional tips to help in this area. But can you share one or two successful regenerative, where your treatments have really helped a patient?
Sure. Yeah, I have found that in treating RA, rheumatoid arthritis, I've found that the gut protocols that I use, and I really focus on mitochondrial flexibility in terms of modulating the immune system. That has been quite helpful. And then the use of a lot of antioxidant plants, such as Oregon grape or berberine. I use a lot of turmeric and curcumin. I also use a lot of lymphagogues. So lymphagogues are something that really helps, in a general sense, just kind of reset the immune system peripherally. So it really helps clean up the lymphatic system so that we can, so our immune system has a better chance at deciding what are important immune responses now, so that we're not conducting old antibody and complement searches that are no longer serve us, that tend to be a part of prolonged inflammatory derangements. I work with adaptogens a lot. These are an important plant group that really helps protect the immune system and organ systems from stress. They tend to help modulate basically how our joint lining responds, how our tendons respond. They tend to decrease fibrosis and inflammation.
Okay.
So, for example, I use Romania for RIA.
Well, hold that thought, because I hear the bumper music. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Sarah about her nutritional education program that can help patients reduce weight, improve metabolism, and tissue repair. So I'm going to put you on hold here, Sarah. And folks, we'll be right back in about 3 minutes. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Sarah Forsythe, MD, Regenerative Healing Educational Consultant. You can call or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week, I'm taking off. Eric Gorham will be here as my guest host. He's got a great lineup. Ryan Rundell, who's a Cal Poly almost graduate. He's leading the Young Republicans in the TPUSA chapter at Cal Poly, and he's got a lot to say. I met him at the Steve Hilton event that the Republican women put on a month or so ago, and he's a delight to talk to. And then we have our old friend Laura Deloy from the Alzheimer's Association coming on. She's going to be talking about some upcoming programs and what's going on with brain health, but she's also bringing in a young lady. Again, she just graduated from Cal Poly. Her name is Amber Petito. She's a graduate in communications, but she also just cared for her mother, who passed away recently, who was suffering from Lewy body disease, Alzheimer's, a form of Alzheimer's, dementia. And she's going to tell her story and how that impacted her very young life. So, Sarah, again, thanks for being with us today. This has been so informative. So before we get to the home stretch here, how's the best way for people to get in touch with you and learn more about how you can help them?
I am at the same office that my husband works out of, so it's Kevin Forsythe, MD, Inc., and I'm there in that office, which is Las Tablas. But you could use a Doc Forsythe at mac.com would probably be the easiest if you want to email. Sadly, I don't even have the phone number here for that office. But I honestly don't know the office number by heart, but he can, but you can always just reach out by email. But it's easy to look him up. He's Dr. Kevin Forsythe, orthopedic surgery. And so I'm in that same office, so I can be reached there.
Great. Well, and folks, full disclosure, Kevin is my orthopedic guy, my knee guy. He's been taking care of the old guy for years here. So if you need the number, send me an email and I'll get that to you. So anyway, so let's talk. You know, you sent me a list of, gosh, I want to say there's about 10 or 15 different choices, things here. We have about 4 minutes left in the show, 3 minutes left.
Sure.
So what do you think are the highlights of your generational nutritional and lifestyle program?
I think the highlights are just kind of narrowing down how to improve mitochondrial function. So there's just different things you can do, from eating windows to really getting your macronutrients appropriate, and then really looking at the response. It's a gut healing protocol that's critical. I think those are very important. The others are just the use of botanicals that really help re-regulate the immune system, really help organs, really support organ systems. So you're really supporting your excretory system, so your liver, your kidneys. Also, in terms of, we talked about a gut protocol, but there are a lot of botanicals that actually are very important, such as the bitters. It's one of the most ignored systems, but bitters, these bitter receptors really help not only move bile out of the body, which removes toxins, but it also is critical for absorption of minerals that are involved in really every intracellular process and communication. And they also, a big thing that gets overlooked is that bitters are also, we have bitter receptors throughout our entire body, and they prevent cancer. They actually treat cancer.
So what are bitters really? What are they?
So bitters are anything, we identify as anything that has a bitter taste. And obviously bitter can mean toxic, but we have a wide review, a large knowledge base of bitters that are helpful. So just arugula, radicchio, those are easy ones to get from food. But there are a lot of plants that are more medicinal in nature. You're not going to eat them for a meal, but such as Oregon grape or the whole berberis family, they are critical in stimulating immune modulation on receptor sites on the cell, on cell membranes throughout different organ systems. And so they're critical at deciding when is it appropriate for a cell to grow, when is it appropriate for it to divide, where is that needed and where is it regulated, because you obviously don't want cells that are growing and dividing inappropriately. And so these, those from food to botanical compounds are bitters that are huge, and they're huge in our brain also for for modulating inflammation. And a critical thing to understand is that a lot of the mental health and neurodegenerative changes we see, these are all inflammatory changes as well. And so it's very key to get those immune regulatory sites modified with appropriate botanicals, foods, and then obviously not to expose yourself to triggers that are causing dysregulated immune responses. And we talked a little bit about those, like volatile phthalates, but anything from exhaust to pesticides, they have binding sites that dysregulate immune responses, and they act as foreign antigens. They will stimulate immune response within the neurologic system. And so it's critical to make sure that we're not exposing ourselves to these to heal our brain.
And diet and high-intensity exercise is really important, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Intermittent, high-intensity intermittent training is a huge benefit to move between that place of aerobic to anaerobic exercise is key to mobilizing. It's basically mobilizing toxins out of the body, and also to get your body to release its own antioxidants. Our most powerful antioxidants are released by exercise.
All right. Well, I hear the music. Sarah, thank you so much for taking time with us today. We'll have you back again, okay? Thank you so much.
Take care. Thanks, Barry.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Folks, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Eric will be in next week with our guests, and have a great rest of the week. Take care.